Test 1, 2.
Hopefully they will arrive a little later. Proceth has a conference committee. Okay. We will greet them as they arrive. First item on the agenda says comments by the chairman regarding committee responsibilities, and it's my understanding this will be our last get together and no? We'll see where this committee goes from this session, but the Hay Group will probably need to report to somebody at the end of the contract in June. We met again with leadership this morning, and regarding some of that, we didn't really come out with much this time of the session. They are involved up to their eyeballs. This is the part of the session where leadership earns their pay. So I'm not sure just where they're at and where we're going with that, but I know that it is certainly the intention, whether during this session or in the next biennium, to implement the recommendations coming forward. So with that, if Mr. Kenning, if you're ready to make your presentation, I'm going to invite you to present it as you would like.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be with you again. Even though it says presentation, what's been agreed with this committee leadership was there is no new presentation this afternoon, seeing as it was a week since we last presented. So the document that is up in front of you is the document that was presented to you last week. Since we concluded the meeting just before 6 o'clock this day last week, what we've been focused on was we've been sent a series of questions or clarifications or additional information that we were requested to concentrate on preparing a response for. And so in agreement with the leadership of this committee this morning, the intention is for me to go through these questions and provide an explanation of the questions that were provided. So I'm not sure if members of the committee received those questions. This came out of Legislative Council staff, and if not, I will I'll read the question and then provide a response to it, and if necessary we'll reference a page that is in here. The first question that was, and it said areas to focus on with leadership and discussions with the committee. Provide additional information on the market comparison in-state and out-of-state, the weighting factor, some of the key organizations being compared to by occupational type. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, at some point this afternoon I'm going to be going to the whiteboard to do some of the explanation, and I recognize for some of you that's behind you, but at some point I'll be doing that. I want to, and also Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, to answer some of the questions that were posed, we have a handout, and I'll reference what I have at the point in time when I come to that, and you can say yes, distribute that, or no, we don't need it, or we can pick it up later. So one of the first things was the identification of the organizations. As was mentioned last Thursday, there were effectively five sources of that. One was the custom survey of in-state public and private sector employers, which was 53 organizations, job service data, which had about 4,000 organizations, the MDHA healthcare survey, and then the Hay Group database that already had organizations in of 123, and then there's 10 central states. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I have, if you would like me to hand out at this point in time, the list of all those organizations. And what it also provides you with is of the 160 benchmark positions, which benchmark positions were compared to which survey. So would you like me to distribute that now, or people can collect it later, or what's the will?
That might be helpful.
Okay.
Did you see Representative Metcalf arrive? Oh, I thought he was going to stay.
And for council, I'll just leave the rest of the, for the other members here, I'll just leave them up here. And they're all identified by what the different areas are.
You have one more, Neville?
Yes. Now, it's not my intention to go through these in detail, otherwise we'll quickly lose a quorum. But just to get you familiar with them, it shows the 53 organizations in the customs survey, which benchmark positions were matched to the customs survey, the 10 states and which benchmark positions were matched to those. It does not list the over 4,500 North Dakota organizations that are in the job service data, but shows which positions were matched to that. The Hay Group, all organizations in North Dakota, 123 organizations, which means they have, the way our database is coded is that that means there are those organizations who have employees within North Dakota, and then it lists the Healthcare Foundation participants and which positions were matched to those. The second question was related to the additional information on a benefits comparison, particularly related to health insurance. Where you will recall on the benefits information, we basically stated the position that on average your benefits were 5 to 7% ahead of the market, and primarily driven off the retirement plan. And so the question that was raised was, why wasn't healthcare, which is perceived to be above the market, why was that not listed as above the market? And so what we've done, Mr. Chairman, is, and once again I will hand this out, is...
Are you going to explain to us what the codes and the grade letters mean?
Yeah, sorry. And what the, Mr. Chairman, what the members of the committee, what the chairman has just asked is state of North Dakota, I said Dakota, I've been coming here too long. State of North Dakota job code is basically a code within the current system for that particular classification. So there's roughly 900 jobs still. Just under 900 jobs. Every one of those jobs has a classification code. The grade, so then is the benchmark position, that's a title of an existing classification. The grade is the grade to which this position will be allocated in the new grade structure that has been developed. You recall at the moment there are grades 1 through 20, and I mentioned last week about we're not calling them 1 through 20 anymore, they have letters. V being the highest, and C on the benchmark positions, V being a higher grade than C. So they're basically going from the start of the alphabet towards. The custom survey code number is just the identifier that we have within the way in which we did our custom survey of the particular description of that job that was sent out to organizations and asked them to match that. So column 1 and 2 are existing, the current code and the title. Column 3 is the proposed grade, and the reason we have that is that we wanted to make sure we have a cross-section of jobs by grades. Now clearly you can see there are some grades are more heavily populated than others in terms of benchmarks. The reality is there are more jobs in grades G, H, I, J, K, etc. It's the nature of the mix of jobs in state government than there are in V or C. But the aim was to get a cross-section by occupational group and by grade. Any other questions on that first item? The second item then was the question was, it added information on the benefits comparison with a specific question asked on health insurance benefit regarding other comparisons. And so basically, as I said, the issue was, Why didn't healthcare come out above? Because it is 100% employer paid. In terms of the, and we explained last week the way in which we value a benefit, which is to work off the basis of the extent to which is rounded up to be employer paid and the extent to which the employee pays in terms of the premium, it reduces the competitiveness. The key on healthcare as to why the why we came to the conclusion that we did is that in our healthcare benefit, you pay at two points in time. You either pay through your paycheck or you pay through point of service. Now, if you pay through your paycheck, then now in North Dakota's case, there is no pay through the paycheck because it's employer paid. The other point at which you pay is the point of service when you receive the service through the healthcare system. While your pay at paycheck time is above market, your pay at receipt of service is below market. And what we've done, and once again I'll hand these out, is we've provided a summary of the healthcare provision in a lot more detail in terms of employee contributions, the office visit copay, the prescription copay, coinsurance, the deductible, the out-of-pocket limits, and dental. And what we've done is we've said what's provided in terms of the percentage of the comparison to the state of North Dakota compared to the private sector in market, in state, and compared to central states. So I'll hand those out, and then a second document that I'm going to hand out is what's called a prevalence of practice. And what the prevalence of practice does is it takes what's going to be on the first page summary and it gets into line item detail and a lot of detail in terms of the cost, employee dependence. And I'll give you an example. Cost employee is employer paid, and you'll see in the private sector, and I'm not going to go through this in detail, but I want to get you, well, maybe I'll hand that out first. That'll be a good idea. Council when I need. So, as I said, it's not my intention to go through line by line a detail, but the first page is effectively the one page summary here is effectively a summary of the second handout which I gave to you, which is the detail of prevalence of practice. And to get you familiar with that, on the second page, which says prevalence of benefits practice, it takes it in terms of cost, doctor's visits, deductible copays, medical plan coverage in terms of deductible, individual, family, the coinsurance, the stop-loss limits, etc., etc. And then it gets into it in dental. And to get you familiar with that second page, for example, if you look at cost to the employee, state of North Dakota is employer paid. Selected state governments, 90% require some contributions for all salary levels. 40% are employer paid, 60% involve cost sharing. Of these, 60% require the employee to pay less than 15%, and 40% require the employer to pay between 15 to 29%. In the private sector, 89% require the same contributions for all salary levels. 7% are employer paid, 93% involve cost sharing, etc. So immediately you go, we're above market. True. Because that's the paycheck. Does the money come out of the paycheck? But then when you get into, as I said, doctor's visits, and co-pays and deductibles, etc., you can see, and it's summarized on the first sheet without going through line item, you have a 20, and let's look at office visit co-pays. You have a 25% co-pay. In the private sector, 28% have a $15 copay, 37% have a $20 copay, and only 23 have a copay of $25 or higher. So while your paycheck contribution is above market, your copay is below market from that perspective. Compared to central states, 43% have a $15 copay, 29% have a $20 copay, and only 28% have a copay of $25 or more. The purpose of this, without going through line by line with you, is to be able to provide you the basis by which we are able to say that compared to both the in-state market and to the other states, while your paycheck, which is one place where dollars can be taken out, is above market, the point of service is below market because of some of the items, and so that you, some of the an example of an item that I just gave to you. If you look at a comparison of a dollar value on an employer-paid basis of healthcare, you're pretty much right on line with the 50th percentile of the market. And by the way, the employer-paid value of healthcare, the way we do our model, is about $10,000. Now that's not the cost. Because remember last week we talked about the employer paid value of it. Compared to the private sector, it's about, and you compared to the private sector is about $10,200. So that's why, I mean, it is so close to the average of the market from that perspective. That's why we came to the conclusion that healthcare was not out of line with the marketplace.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Neville, just back up a little bit to the copay portion of your presentation. In my understanding, are you giving the same weight to the copay as to what the state pays for insurance? I mean, when you, in your formula?
Basically, Mr. Chairman, Representative, what we do is we go through and we look at all the components of a benefit. In this case, they're basically broken into two aspects, the paycheck component or the point of service component. There's no weighting given to any being greater or less than the other, because we roll everything up to treat it as if it's an employer paid basis. So it's not like, well, we're weighting paycheck greater than point of service. They're all put into the mixer from that perspective, and to add up to what's the employer paid value. Okay, so there is no sort of greater or lesser weighting from that perspective.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Continue.
Maybe I'm just missing it, but so the state really gets no credit for paying 100% for health insurance, but yet gets dinged a little bit for having a $25 copay at the point of visit?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative, no, that's not correct. If in fact, because you sort of got one thing that's on the positive side of the ledger, you got some things that are on the negative side of the ledger. Overall, that's really saying you're coming out at about the average of the marketplace, the way in which we value a benefit. Because remember, the dollar cost we take out of the equation when we value a benefit. And the reason is, and my colleague Melinda explained this last week, if in fact, and I know to an Appropriations Committee person, that's what's important because they are the real dollars, but the reason why we take cost and demographics out of it is that if half your workforce retired tomorrow and was replaced with a workforce that is half the age of those that retired, this benefit value, the way we express it, would not change, because the paycheck aspect and the point of service aspect would not change. Your premium may go down, Okay? But, and that's why we take demographics out of play, because just because someone retires may impact your cost, but it doesn't impact the way that the benefit is expressed.
Okay.
Representative Casper.
Mr. Chairman Neville, if the state of North Dakota is paying 100% of the premium for the employees, what dollar value would you give that to on an annual basis based upon what your numbers are doing right now? When you look at all the numbers you've put in front of us, what dollar value does that equate to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we don't calculate that dollar value of just that one-sided equation. What we've done is we've calculated what's the dollar value of the health care benefit to employees, and it's roughly $10,000. Okay, now that's taking into consideration both sides of the equation, the employer paid aspect, the paycheck aspect, and the and the point of service aspect. So if, for example, you required, the way we do our methodology, if you required a contribution to premiums, that dollar value would decrease. Okay? If the cost of your premiums went up, the way we do our methodology, it would not change that value. Your premiums may go up, but because we're trying to take cost out of it, cost is, I understand that cost is what it's costing, you know, from an appropriation perspective, but we've tried to take, that's why we convert everything to an employer paid value, so that it takes things such as premium changes, it takes things such as workforce demographic changes out of the equation.
May I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Continue.
So let's go to the, let's look at a private sector, where you said $10,000, the value of the premium. So now when we compare that $10,000 of zero cost to the employee in the state government, and if we have a 50% employee contribution in the private sector, that means there's a cost of $5,000 to the employee compared to zero to the state employee in the private sector compared to state employee. What value does that difference have in your methodology as far as how we compare with the private sector in the state of North Dakota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe you're mixing dollars here, because the dollars I'm talking about at $10,000 is the value that we've placed on the retiree benefit. If you said the cost, I think your question was if the employee's required to contribute $5,000, is that what you say?
In the private sector.
Yeah, that's not going to be a straight $5,000 correlation, because we'd have to look at what the percentage of, you're now comparing premiums to a value, and that's not an apples-to-apples comparison.
Well, I'm trying to compare real world to real world, and what I hear you giving us is stuff that has no application in common sense. Your methodology may be your methodology, but in the real world, employees look at dollars out of their pocket compared to dollars they don't have to spend.
Mr. Chairman, I experienced those sort of words last week. You either want, you want me to continue rationally, or, I mean, I'm just taking a pause so I don't respond inappropriately.
Neville, if we look at the sheet that says prevalence of benefits and practices in the private sector, it appears that 93% involve cost sharing.
That's correct.
Of that, 56% require the employee to pay 15 to 29%. Would that 15 to 29% then relate to $10,000, $1,500 to $2,900?
Which part are you reading from, Mr. Chairman?
I'm looking under the column private sector.
In the white sheet, the big packet. Page one of the big packet.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you. Sorry, I was looking at the summary page. 56% requiring the employee to pay 15 to 29% of the premium. That's what that refers to. So if the premium is...
Does that relate to the $10,000?
No. It does not. And that's the important, that's the part I'm trying to get across. The benefits methodology removes demographics from this, so that if your premium goes up or your premium goes down, we look at what the value of the benefit is. Because the reason we do that is to say, what is the total remuneration package value to an employee? Okay. And so let's assume that the premium that the employer is required to pay for that employee is $5,000. Okay. What that says is, in your case, the premium that you'd pay, what the state of North Dakota is paying is $5,000. In that private sector comparison, the 56% of the employees are required to pay between 15 to 29% of that $5,000. The extent to which the employee is required to contribute reduces the benefit value. That's the paycheck aspect. There's the point of service aspect, which is, what am I required to pay when I utilize the service? I repeat what I mentioned before. You are more competitive on the paycheck aspect. You are less competitive when we utilize the service.
I think the thing that we're trying to struggle with is how we quantify that difference.
And that's what our methodology has done. Now, what we could do is run a, I couldn't do this for you here, but what we could do is say, okay, if the employee is required to contribute X percent. In other words, we could run the sort of scenarios that are said, okay, if what's listed under the private sector here was the state of North Dakota's plan, what would that do to the benefit value? I could get that information for you if that's what you're asking. I can't get it for you right now, but I can get Melinda, who was with me last week, to run those numbers for you.
That might be useful.
Yeah, that would make more sense.
Okay. Can you, maybe we could get her, she may be able to run it now. I got Melinda and the other analyst on standby if there was anything that came out, so that I can give you, have you got her number?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Ken might be moving a little slow today. It's part of the aging process, I think.
I know. Mr. Chairman, can I take 10 seconds to give him the number and he can call her directly? Is that all right?
Sure. Fifty-eight years old today, I understand. Of course, I've sworn to secrecy on that.
So we'll see if we can get her to run that now while the committee's still in. If not, it'll be here first thing tomorrow morning, Mr. Chairman.
We'll distribute whatever information comes after the meeting.
So the question that if the private sector, well, if North Dakota read the same as that private sector under cost, what would that do to the benefits competitiveness?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing so that you got the other side of that equation, is that in terms of copays, if North Dakota's was in line with the private sector as well, what would that do to the benefit value? In other words, if what you currently have as a plus is in line with the private sector, what would that do? If what you currently have as a minus was in line with the private sector, what would that do? So you got both sides of the equation. Okay, the third question that was related was, discuss the use of benchmark positions in the comparisons. How many employees in each agency were benchmark positions? How were the market comparisons made for non-benchmark positions? And how the salary adjustments were determined based on the benchmark and non-benchmark positions for each agency? The next handout I have for the committee, Mr. Chairman, I'll hand it out and then I'll explain. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what's being passed out is by agency. Remember, there are about 160 positions we used as benchmarks out of the 900, and the purpose, as we explained before, was to get a cross-section of positions. That's a pretty standard sort of percentage. And you can see here the first column is agencies, the second column is total number of positions in that agency. You should go to the third column, which was the total number of positions matched to the survey benchmark. Then the total number of incumbents that represents, and the number of full-time incumbents in the benchmarks. So there were, out of the 7,193 employees, over 50% of the employees were represented by benchmark positions. And you recall last week we went through and we did a comparison of where occupational groups and agencies fell related to the benchmark positions relative to the market. So the question is then, how do we combine the survey data to be able to establish the salary structure, and hence how do we establish the pay for non-benchmark positions? And if I could just go over to the whiteboard now, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right with you, and I want to explain how this is done. Is that right?
That's fine. I'm wondering how we're going to pick up your voice on that recorder.
I'll use my outside voice.
Okay.
Just, he can take the mic. He can take the number of people in that position.
Mm-hmm.
Where at? In the private sector?
No, it should be in that agency.
DNA. Total number of positions. So they have 26.
Basically, as Representative Boning has mentioned, we just play tic-tac-toe, and that's how we come up with a salary structure. But basically, across the top here, it's the survey source. So it could have been the central state's data. It could have been the custom survey. It could have been the North Dakota health survey. It could have been the Hay database. It could have been the job service database. So that's across the top here. Then down here is a list of 160 positions, which are the benchmark positions. We take the survey data from each of those sources, organized by grade, and that was what those letters were on the benchmark positions, and we basically gather the data. We're basically getting the data of the various positions from the various survey sources. And so then what we do over the side here, by grade, is we're looking for what the average of that data is. And let's assume that on that grade it's $100,000. Now we don't take it just at absolute value. We are looking at all these data sources and we're going, that one says 100, that says 100, that says 98, that one says 210. If it says 210, and these are illustrative numbers, we are probably not going to use it because it's just so inconsistent. So we'll do what we call hide that data. We're not going to utilize it. So then what we do is that by each of the grades, we've got a value over here. And I'm going to keep the math really simple here. That might be 80, that might be 90, that might be 70, etc., etc. Once we've done that, we then plot that data, and this is the link between the grade structure and the market. So dollars are here, and jobs, which are represented by job evaluation points, which are representative of the classifications, are plotted on that axis. The grade structure, effectively, is that axis there, with the biggest job being up here and the smallest job being over here. And so we plot those data points like that, and then we regress that data. It is not a straight line, and in fact the salary structure being recommended actually goes like that. It's steeper at the bottom and it's flatter at the top. That's not unusual in the public sector. The private sector tends to go the other way. What you don't want is a line that goes like that, because that's a good news, bad news story. It's the good news you got a promotion, the bad news is we took money away from you. So each of these represent one of the benchmark positions. And so what a grade and salary structure does is it effectively says there is the spread of points by grade and there's the spread of dollars by grade. Now, what if there's 160 position, what about the other 740? One of the reasons why you don't survey every position in the marketplace is you won't find a match for it. So let's assume then that we've got a job here that's at 300 points, and points is just a representative job content, and the market is $30,000. And we've got another benchmark position that's at 400 points, and the market is at $40,000. Keep the example simple. And you go, what about the non-benchmark positions? In here, we may have a benchmark position that's at 332 points. How do we arrive at the recommended salary market for a non-benchmark position? It's purely driven off what the slope of that line is, and to keep the math simple, because we don't have data for it, at 33,200 is the way that we would arrive at the benchmark, at the salary range for it. Now, how do we also use this for premium pay positions? There might be 60 jobs in that grade there, and that spread around that market average is very tight. But there's a job up here in the marketplace. How do we handle that? It's what's called, and you remember last week we talked about a premium pay position. And if, let's assume that job's a pharmacist, because we know there's a premium for pharmacists. What we don't do is say, well, we need to call that job in that grade there. Let's say that's grade K, and this is grade T. We don't call it a T, because the other K's go, if that's a T, I should be a T. And the T's go, if that's a T, I should be a Z. The way that we handle that is what we call a K parenthesis T, which means it belongs with the K's from a job evaluation and grade perspective, but the market says we need to be paying it a T. That's what's called a premium. Now, the other aspect of that we talked about, which we need to address, is the oil patch situation. There's a pretty good chance that the premium for a pharmacist will continue. But some of the oil patch situations which we want to be careful about based on your past experience is that we may face this situation, but it may be temporary. The way that we do that is what we call an add-on. Whereas the market might be 40, but it's 100 for a pharmacist, we'll establish that as the salary. Whereas an oil patch, we may go, the typical market's 40, we need to pay 80, but it may be temporary. We'll do it as a 40 add-on so that we can review that, and if it goes away. Whereas the 100,000 may be what's used for benefits purposes. In the add-on situation, it may be that we're using 40 for benefits purpose, and I don't fully know what's done in North Dakota at the moment, in the state at the moment, but it's my understanding that that part may not necessarily be benefitable. It's not a lot of word, but you understand what I'm saying? So that's how, and I hope I haven't lost you in the mess here, that's how we establish, first of all, what was the recommended salary structure, and secondly, how we establish the salary range for non-benchmark jobs. The salary structure is the appropriate balance between internal equity and the external market. So the key question for you is, in accordance with the compensation philosophy, is not so much what that structure should be, but what level in the market should we be setting effectively the blue line in the middle. And you recall last week that we presented two options, one where the market policy position was set at the market average and one which was set at 98%. We were asked subsequently in the last week to provide what does a 96% one look like and what does a 95% one look like. Now, I want to stress to you as the keepers of the purse strings as the legislature that we get the sequence of the decision making appropriate. What we shouldn't be doing is establishing our policy based on what we can afford. What we should be doing is setting our policy based on what we think is the appropriate level in the marketplace. We then should, here are the, Mr. Chairman, I know I'm getting to the end, but I should have made this comment at the start. The three key things that we need to be considering as policymakers. One, what level in the market should we adopt as our policy position? Two, fund getting people to minimum of the salary ranges as a separate pot of money from what is potentially being talked about and what's being appropriated. Do not use up appropriated money for getting people to minimum. That's a cost of establishing new salary ranges. And then the third aspect is, once we've got people into the salary ranges, what is the, that's when you can consider, what is the funding that's available? A, needed, but B, available, because once we've got people into the salary ranges, we can manage a plan. We being the keepers of the plan. So what we shouldn't be doing is saying, well, this is the amount of money we have available, which structure should we adopt? It's the other way around. What's our policy position? Hence, what's the cost associated with that? And there are two costs associated with that. One is the policy position, the bring to minimum, and secondly is you know, what's the next salary increments going to be? And we set out in our audit report the means by which salaries could be administered, which is not a market adjustment separate from a performance adjustment separate from an equity adjustment. Roll those monies together and take those two things into consideration at the same time. Any questions on that item, Mr. Chairman, or members of the committee?
I don't see any.
Okay. The fourth question, please further explain the issue of the width of the salary ranges. Currently, your salary ranges, your market policy position is set at 95% of market. The minimum is 75% of that value, and the maximum is set at 125% of that value. And what we've proposed is that the minimum be set at 80% and the maximum be set at 125%. And why do we do that? One reason is that if we have ranges that are, and three of the four options were setting a policy position that was at less at the market average, why would we be establishing a salary minimum that's so significantly below that if we want to attract the sort of quality of employees that we want? Now, so why then keep it at the maximum of 125%? Because we have a pay-for-performance philosophy, what we want to do is, if someone's been around for a while and continues to be a sustained high performer, there is still some headroom for them to continue to receive some salary increases. Now, in the audit presentation we made back in October, we did talk about the fact that as someone gets high into their salary range, and say they warranted a 3% increase, that may not all be in salary. It could be that 1.5% is in salary and 1.5% is in a lump sum payment. The number of people that are over maximum in the current, so the question was raised, well, how could people be below minimum and above maximum? In the current structure, they're not. People are within those salary ranges. The reason there's people are below minimum and above maximum in the proposed structure is for two reasons. One is the ranges are changed, and secondly, on the horizontal axis there, where we went through and reviewed every job in terms of its appropriate allocation, a position could be below minimum because it was undervalued in terms of its job evaluation in the current system. That was the case in a number of the human service positions. One of the reasons a job could be above maximum in the new structure, it was overvalued from a job evaluation perspective in the current structure. By the way, this is not really going to be an issue for going forward, the number of people above maximum, because on the two options we did last week, the 100% and the 98%, I think it was something like 64 or 68% of people, once we've got people to minimum, we're going to be below the market policy position. Particularly for longer serving people and up to the last two or three years where the range, both the ranges and the funding to market have not been in line with market, you've got some long serving people who haven't even made the market policy position in your current structure. Provide options for setting the market policy position, which, as I mentioned before, we were asked to provide two more options, and we've provided those to council of a 96% option and a 95% option. The dollars to break, so I'll take the two extremes. The 100% policy, setting the policy at 100% of the market average, what we're asked to do was what's the cost you bring to minimum. General fund on an annualized basis at the 100% was about just over $4 million. At a 98% option, it was $3.1 million. And at the lower option, at 95%, it's roughly $2 million. So the cost halves between the market average option and the 95% option. So roughly 2 million in the low 2 millions at a 96, about 2.2 million, about 3.1 million at a 98, and a 4 million general fund monies on an annualized basis.
And because we operate on a biennium, that's a double that.
Correct? Okay. And once again, I can't stress enough, whatever is required to bring to minimum, I would strongly encourage you that be set as a separate pot of money. Because otherwise, whatever monies are available is going to be eaten up, just getting some of it is going to be eaten up bringing people to minimum. So if one of your questions, and I remember, Mr. Chairman, at the start of last week's meeting was, you mentioned about the process by which this committee could do its work was it didn't have to make dollar decisions. It could, if there were dollar decisions to be made, it could be appropriated through the OMB budget, OMB bill, or whatever it is.
That's possible.
Right.
You play with the money.
Right. The point I'm making is that any appropriation, if there is an appropriation recommendation comes out of this committee, I would strongly recommend that an appropriate, whatever option is chosen from a policy perspective and the dollars associated to bring people to minimum be a separate appropriation. Options, and the next one was options in process for continuing implementation if no additional funding is added to the budgets. Well, I believe, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I've just been talking about that. If I can just check, of that, the 22.9 million number that you gave me is on a biennium basis, of which 16.9 is for classified employees on a biennium basis, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, that question is, if there's no additional funding and we adopt set it policy position, on a biennium basis, that would take up roughly $8 million of that $16.9 million to bring people to minimum. Some people would get a $5,000 increase, some people would get a $2 increase. It's whatever it is to bring cost to minimum. You will have used up almost 50% of what you've appropriated on a biennium basis for roughly 1,200 or so of the employees to bring them to minimum. So the question was the process for continued implementation. The reality is that there would be roughly 1.6% available for salary increases for the remaining employees over that period of time. So the more money that you use and bring into minimum, the less money there is for adjustments for other employees. Now, could it be? So then it becomes just how much money is available. About the XYZ that we talked about, the reality is that the less money that there is available, the less fancy you want to get. You don't spend a whole lot of time playing around with, and you never expect me to say this as a fan of pay for performance, but if the pot is 1.6%, you don't spend a whole lot of time differentiating between who should get 5% and who should get 0%, because the pot just isn't sufficient across a population of roughly 7,200 employees.
And we have talked in terms of taking a couple of bienniums to accomplish this.
Right. So any questions related to that?
Questions? I don't see any.
Number seven was consider how tuition reimbursement benefit is presented. You recall last week that we talked about it didn't have a value because there was not a statewide policy on that, although some agencies do provide some tuition benefits. If we, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if we can provide it with what is the Typical agency biennial, sorry, typical agency tuition reimbursement benefit, we could put a, we could apply a methodology to that, would come up with a value. I can tell you in terms of the overall benefit value, it will have very little impact in terms of the level of competitiveness. The eighth item we were asked to comment on was what about the other components? And you recall that there were 10 components that we're addressing, and the focus over the last month or so has really been on the state compensation philosophy, the development of the grade structure, the development of the salary structure to come up with costing implications. We fully recognize that we're not finished, and you touched on that, Mr. Chairman, at the start. To achieve a completion of what we required, what we've been asked to do against all the other components, and we gave this to you in the March 3rd document, Legislative Council has extended the contract with the Hay Group through the 30th of June, and whatever is the appropriate body, whether it be this committee or an interim committee, we would request that we have a meeting with whatever is the appropriate body or bodies, probably in the last 10 days of June, where we can give a report on what's been done on all aspects, some of which are really dependent on the decisions that come out in terms of is what the salary structure is going to be. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that we were asked to do was look at firming up the use of what's called a retention and recruitment bonus. Well, finalization of the positions that are premium pay and how they will be treated, and filling up those that are what we call add-on pay positions, which may very well be in the oil patch, firming up of how we treat those will have an impact on the firming up of the definition of what is the recruitment bonus. For example, if you pay a retention bonus for 5 years in a row, it's not a retention bonus. There's something that tells you there's something going on in the market here. So we need to firm up those first two aspects. We will then come in that report and say, and here's how recruitment, here's how retention bonuses should be. If we've got more competitive salary ranges, then the extent to which recruitment bonuses are used should be diminished. So I'm just giving an example of how some of these other aspects are dependent on some of the decisions that are made here. But we have not forgotten about them. The contract's been extended. We believe it's appropriate, seeing as the contract is with the legislative branch, that we make a final presentation in the last 10 days of June on all the components and the outcomes of those. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, they are the 10, all the areas that of questions, the eight areas of questions that were sent through that there was to be further explanation of. I've been through each of those. I have no additional handouts at this point in time other than the ones that have been given to provide explanation. So that concludes my part of the presentation for today.
Are there any questions? If not, I think probably what I will do after this meeting is put together a letter with some recommendations with the assistance of council to provide to leadership in order that they can provide greater direction going forward into June. And as far as which committee would hear that final report, I'll talk to them at the end of the session when they're a little easier to talk to. So maybe the end of next week.
Mr. Chairman, I have absolutely no right to provide some input to the constituency of that committee, but I got the microphone. One thing I would encourage as you do that is that it's very useful, as it was from the Government Services Committee to the constituency of this committee, and as I would hope to whatever that next committee is that as much as possible we get some common members so we don't have to start from scratch. And that I think that was help, you know, some, those that you were on the audit committee and now are on this, if I could encourage you to do that, that would be useful, because otherwise we run the risk of, well, we've got to start from scratch way back at February 2010. Now I'm quite happy to do that, but that would be sort of the completion. And You know the democratic process, Mr. Chairman, as well as I do. The more people that have a finger in the pie, the longer it's going to take to get some of this stuff through. So I appreciate the chance to meet with you again today.
I don't know about the rest of the committee, but I'm as common as they get.
Hmm? You're as common as they get?
I said common members, and yeah. That would be me.
That was parliament. That was the parliamentary system, a member of the House of Commons. So. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Before we go to the next order of business, I was informed that an earlier order of business should have been the approval of the minutes from March 3rd and April 7th. I have a motion and a second. Do you need to know who? Motion and a second to approve the minutes of both of those meetings. We don't need to call the roll. Nope. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's carried. Next item, OMB. Ken, are you? Oh. We're going to the top.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Pam Sharp. I'm the Director of the Office of Management and Budget. I just have a few comments, and what the agenda actually asked me to do is to give you the appropriate percentage for the state's market policy position, which is a huge decision, and I believe I need to defer that decision to your committee. When the interim committee hired the Hay Group, they had some a lot of things they wanted the Hay Group to accomplish, and I believe they accomplished everything that they've been asked to do, and they provided a lot of information. They were asked to do this in a time frame of which was, you know, have the recommendations by today. So I do, if you're going to, you know, send a letter to leadership with some recommendations, I strongly encourage you to do that. I know the intent of the original interim committee was that this information be received by the middle of April so that some decisions could be made by the legislative body to implement all of the recommendations. And while HRMS was working with the Hay Group, it was just very valuable information, a very valuable process that they went through. At the interim committee's request, HRMS did purchase the Hay Group's software for the job evaluation system, and they have found that to be very, very valuable. We'll continue using that software. I believe the market survey was, you know, we've never really been able to get a handle on the market, and so I think that was very, very, very valuable. So we at HRMS, at OMB, we are ready to stand by and implement all of the recommendations that you choose under the direction of the Hay Group. So, and they are on contract through the end of June. So I think that's a very good move by council to extend the contract so that we can have some help implementing your wishes. So I think it's been a very, very good process, and I look forward to knowing what your recommendations, what your decisions are going to be.
Any questions? Assuming whatever level of funding, all the pieces are in place to begin the implementation.
That's correct. We need, for starters, we need to know what that percentage of market policy decision is going to be. That needs to be in place so that everything else can fall into place. And then once that decision is made and the amount of money, those would be the two parameters that we would work around. And again, under Mr. Kenning's direction, I have no doubt we could begin implementation of these recommendations.
It's my understanding, and it appears to me that many different agencies have been involved in the process, so they would be in a position to participate in that process.
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. Many, many individuals from many agencies have been involved in the process with the job evaluation system. They know how it's going to work. Very, very supportive of the process.
Is there any additional information that you see that the Hay Group should be developing going forward?
Well, I think it's just a huge amount of information that they have given us, and I think we just need to take that information and go with it. They're an extremely reputable group, and I think you actually hired the very best.
Okay. Any questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
I look forward to working together on that, and OMB budget's the big one that comes up, and I'm sure you'll find some money within your budget to move forward on this. Are there any other persons that would like to comment on the recommendations or the study? If not, is there any additional committee discussion regarding the implementation? If not, Representative Rust?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Will we be getting a printed report on this?
Neville, do you intend at the end of June to provide something like that, or?
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative, that's the intention of that final, that the contract's been extended to the 30th of June so that we can give you a final report. And the parts that have been done so far would clearly be part of that. But as we did with the interim committee, where we were required to produce a final report, we will do the same thing, but we just can't do it yet because of some other components. So yes, we will by the end of June.
Continue.
If I may continue, that final report then would contain your recommendations at the end as well, I would assume?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, absolutely, because there's some recommendations on all the components that we're working on. Correct. Mr. Chairman, Representative, some of them, of course, there'll be recommendations made at this point. By that point in time, we will know what decisions have been made, but we won't adjust a recommendation because of a decision made. You know, if a decision made is not what we recommended, for example, if we said we recommended that you should set the market policy position at a particular level of market and you choose a different one, that will not alter it from the fact that we want to place on record that that would be the recommendation that we made. Correct?
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? If not, we will stand adjourned. I'm not going to take a vote.